And true to form, it wouldn't be a Sunday if I didn't forget something. Did we forget the slide dismissing children to junior church? We didn't forget. It was up. Did they leave? Did they leave? Did all the parents who wanted to go with them get a chance to leave? This is your chance to get out. This could be a little rough and bumpy. It's been a while. Keith mentioned earlier that the theme or the focus for this Sunday is friendship, and that's one of the themes that dominates chapter 20 of 1 Samuel. And so I wanted to throw out a question for you this morning. Who was your best friend growing up? Who was your best friend growing up? If a face or a name immediately came to mind, would you put up your hand? Isn't that something, hey? We all had that friend. And what's remarkable to me is every once in a while in life, I meet somebody who's still friends with that person, even though it's been a long time. For me, it was 1975. It was Salmon Arm, BC. It was Salmon Arm Elementary, and I was put into a grade that was a split grade. It was a grade 2-3 mix. I should have been in grade 2, and there were a bunch of grade 3ers there, and the teacher said, write down the name of the person you would like to sit beside, because we had tables. We didn't have desks. And I wanted to sit with Ross Ferguson, because I thought Ross was super cool, and he was a grade 3-er, and grade 3-ers are cooler than grade 2-ers. But I was not savvy in the ways of the world. I did not realize that the grade 3-ers were angry about being in a class with grade 2-ers and wanted nothing to do with the grade 2-ers, and they didn't want anything to do with me, and Ross didn't want to have anything to do with me. But there was also a boy who was brand new to our school. He had moved down from Prince George. He was living with his grandmother. It was kind of a foster care situation. His mother was in a position where she couldn't take care of him, and so he had come to Salmon Arm. And he didn't have any friends, and I had secured a position for myself where I had no friends. And so we became friends. Me and Mark Woods became the best of friends. The next year, Mark's mom was in a better place, and he was returned to his mom in Prince George. But every summer, he would come and visit his grandmother. And I would so look forward to those 2 weeks, and I would know roughly the time, and I would just start showing up at their house and keep showing up at their house until Mark arrived, and we would play, and we would just get into so much trouble together. And we didn't know we were getting into trouble. We weren't trying to get into trouble. It just came naturally to us, like the time we rode his red wagon down the hill from his grandmother's place, and there was this T-intersection, and if you leaned hard enough, you could go down another hill, get even more momentum, and you could roll right into the GMC truck lot. And if you laid flat on the wagon, you could actually scoot right under some of those trucks. And we thought that was great fun. I guess the salesmen were really enamored with our creativity, too, because they brought us into the sales office and gave us 7-Up and asked us our names. What's your name? Norman Roy Blake. Oh, and where do you live, Norman? We live, blah, blah. Maybe you know my father. Here's my phone number. I had no idea how my father figured it out, or why he was so angry that night, or why it took so long to sit properly again. You know, there was all kinds of questions that surrounded that event. But that was me and Mark. It was just great. I learned how to water ski with Mark and his cousin. She took us out on his grandpa's boat. We lived right on the shoe shop. We took that boat out. We sat on the lake and we played and we swam and we water skied and we ate and we fell asleep and got sunburns and all of that. It was glorious. It was glorious. Friendship's just something truly special, isn't it? And probably the most famous friendship in all of the Bible, outside of Jesus and the disciples, is the friendship between Jonathan and David. They were incredibly good friends. They were just BFFs. They truly and sincerely loved each other. But David had a problem. David had a problem. And it started with the whole David and Goliath story. David, this small person, smaller than all his brothers, goes to the battlefront and sees Israel in disarray. Even Saul, their champion king, was afraid to confront Goliath, and David just walks out there and takes him down. And people start to honor David, and they start to celebrate David, and Saul starts to get jealous, and more jealous, till one day he kind of loses his mind and fires a big spear at David. But David's quick. He gets out of the way, and then he books it to this place called Ramah, a certain community in Ramah, Naoth, and Saul comes to hunt him down, but that doesn't work out for Saul, and David comes back, and he gets right up to Jonathan and says, "What's the deal, man? Why is your dad trying to kill me?" And Jonathan says, "Yeah, he's not trying to kill you." David's like, "I'm telling you, he's trying to kill me." And Jonathan's like, no. And David's saying, "I'm telling you, yeah. And I'll tell you what, we'll come up with a little plan. And if it goes this way, you know that he's going to try to kill me. If it goes the other way, you know that he's not." And the plan was, you know, there was this elaborate banquet feast coming up, and David was supposed to be there, and the first day David's not there, and so Saul just kind of rationalizes why he's not there, but like David's still not there after he's supposed to be there, and David and Jonathan had worked out this thing where he says, you know, if your father asks where am I, tell him that I went to be with my family and celebrate with them, and if he says no worries, that's cool, then you know that everything's good. But if he loses his wig again, you know it's not good. You know he's out to get me. And true to form, feast happens. No David. Saul says to Jonathan, "Where's your buddy?" And Jonathan says, "Oh, I went to go hang out with his parents." And Saul loses it. And Jonathan stands up and he defends his friend. He says, "Why are you so mad at him? What did he do to you? Like, what has he done that's been so bad that you want some sort of vengeance on him?" And Saul goes berserk. He loses it on Jonathan. He even throws a spear at his own son, tries to pin him to the wall. But Jonathan gets out of the way. Jonathan's mad. But they had devised a signal, Jonathan and David had, that if Saul was going to kill him, like, regardless, Jonathan was going to go out, fire three arrows into the field. David's hiding behind a pile of rocks. Jonathan sends a boy out to go retrieve the three arrows. And the deal was that if everything was cool, Jonathan would say to the boy, "Come back this way and get the arrows. You've gone too far." And that would be a sign to David that he can come back. But if Saul really wants to kill him, he says, "You know, you haven't gone far enough. Keep going. And that's actually the word to David. "Get out of here. Keep going." And Jonathan calls the boy back, gives him his bow and arrows, and sends him back to town. And Jonathan and David meet and weep and hug each other. Because this is it. This is the last time they're going to be friends. Well, they'll always be friends, but this is the last time they're going to see each other. The last time they're going to be able to embrace each other. This is it. This is goodbye. And this is what we step into. This is what we look like or look at. You know, and I think it just begs the question, like, what does it mean to be a friend? Because Jonathan was truly a friend to David. And I'd like to explore three aspects of friendship as they lay out in this passage. And the first one is love, the second one is commitment, and the third one is sacrifice. So we're just going to work our way kind of through the passage. We're going to look at some key verses which kind of just draw this out. The first one being love, that Jonathan and David, they loved each other like brothers. They just loved each other. 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 14, 15. "If I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." This is a recognition of the love that they shared. And in this translation, the English Standard Version, it goes so far as to say this steadfast love. The Hebrew word for steadfast love is chesed, and it expresses a sense of loyalty and faithfulness that should characterize the life of God's people, because it characterizes the love that God has for us. It's not just a, hey, I love ice cream type of love. It's not a, hey, man, I love you. Hey, buddy. Hey, dude, I love you, man. It's not like the Academy Awards where everybody just loves each other. It's something much deeper, much more profound. It is a true, deep, biblical, godly love. It's what they share. Jonathan and David's love for each other is a picture of what our relationship with the Lord should look like. And it's a reflection of God's faithfulness to his people. We were all horrified by the story in the news this week about the two dogs that killed that 11-year-old boy. But I think we all recognize that that's not typical behavior of dogs. That's not your average dog. There was another story in the news this week about a dog named Hero down in Taber, Alberta, who just faithfully stayed by his master's side. In fact, he created such a ruckus, it compelled people to come over and investigate. And the police came out and they checked it out. And when the man in the ditch, he'd been there for 2 days. When he heard the police, he started calling out and they found him. Because his dog Hero, there's the puppy. He's just so faithful. He just, man's best friend, hey? Man's best friend. And, you know, you think about some of the famous stories, or maybe you've experienced yourself, but there's no relationship really, is there? Quite like the relationship between a boy and his dog. Dogs are just really good at loving you. That's why it hurts so much when they die, I guess. But this is the type of love that God has for us. Psalm 89, verse 14, righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Steadfast love and faithfulness goes before you. Or you think about Jesus in the upper room with his disciples the night before he was betrayed and killed. He says to them, now before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that the hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. To the end. This is Jesus. Love is demonstrated through action. Whenever I'm doing premarital counseling, I always get people to read the 5 love languages. So we kind of have this better sense of how we understand love and how we communicate love. But there is no greater communicator of love than the cross. It demonstrates God's faithfulness to us. And this is the second aspect of this powerful, powerful friendship. Faithfulness, commitment. Jonathan and David, they had made a pact. You can read about it first in chapter 18 and verse 3. But if you look at 1 Samuel 20, verses 16 and 17, it reads, and Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. There's commitment. And in this context, it's described as covenant. And the essence of covenant is to be found in a particular kind of relationship between persons. And mutual obligations characterize that kind of relationship. Thus, a covenant relationship is not merely a mutual acquaintance, but a commitment to responsibility and action. A key word in Scripture to describe commitment is faithfulness, acted out in a context of abiding friendship. When I talk about the major players in the Old Testament, what does God make with Abraham? A covenant. And what does God make with Moses and the people of Israel? A covenant. And what does God make with David ultimately? A covenant. And this is kind of an unusual situation where we see a covenant between two individuals, a covenant between Jonathan and David. And it's hard to know what exactly the nature of that covenant is, because you read enough commentaries, you get a few best guesses, but you get a lot of people who are just more honest, who essentially just say, we don't really know. I would have to guess, and it is a guess, but I think the essence of their covenant was a recognition or an acknowledgement. They realize this whole situation is going to end badly for one of us. I'm Saul's son. I'm Jonathan. I'm Saul's son. I'm the heir to the throne, which makes you my father's enemy, my enemy. But if you usurp my father, then I become your enemy. And what do you do with your enemies? Right? Different time, different place, ancient Near East. But you know what? If you're my enemy, I'm just going to chop your head off, and that's just the way it's going to be. And I think the nature of their covenant was, if I'm king, I won't kill your family. And if you become king, you won't kill mine. And I think that's the arrangement. That's my best guess. Who knows? I've been wrong before. I can be wrong again. But whatever it is, it's a pact. It's a commitment. It's a set of promises. And the best illustration I can find of that is marriage. You know, I was at the dentist, and somebody said, how long have you been married? And I said, this May will be 35 years. And they said, oh, what's the key to a long marriage? And just flippantly, I said, don't sleep with the wrong person. That's really hard on a marriage. But, you know, keep your promises. You stood in front of a priest or pastor or somebody, and you made promises to have and to hold, to love and to cherish, right? Better or worse, sickness and in health, that's a biggie. And not a biggie, it is remarkable, the statistics. If you've never seen them, it's remarkable how many people divorce a sick spouse. I was taking a course or seminar or something once, but there was somebody there from the MS Society, multiple sclerosis. They said that somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of MS diagnoses result in divorce. I know people who have received cancer diagnoses and their spouse said, nope, not what I signed up for. So somebody says, what's one of the greatest blessings you ever had at Hillview? I said, you know, there is no shortage of people in my church who've had spouses who become significantly ill, and they stay and they stick it out and they take care of them and they love them. I know that I take a tremendous amount of diabolical joy in tormenting Gabriella from the pulpit from time to time. It's the only reciprocity I can get for the torment I experience at home sometimes. However, when I got out of the hospital, I was a hot mess. I couldn't bend at the waist. My midsection was just, it wasn't good. It was so bad, I couldn't put on my own socks. And Gabriella would get down on her hands and knees and put on my socks. Whenever I talk to young people, I try to tell them, you know, the blessing of marriage, as exciting as it fun as it is now, with everything's new and you're getting all these presents and you're setting up your house and it's all fun and good, the power of marriage, the true blessing of marriage, is 50 years down the road when you can't do something for yourself and somebody's right there beside you doing it for you. Blessing of marriage is waking up not alone, which is why my heart breaks for those of you who are widowers and widows. I just feel that pain for you, and I pray for you. I spoke to somebody just last week whose husband passed away a few years ago and said, how long were you married? She said, 59 years. I said, it sounds like you miss him. She says, you have no idea. You have no idea. You live that long with somebody, it's become part of your soul. You know, marriage is a commitment. It's a promise. It's a pact. It's through thick and thin, hell and high water, right? It's you and me, baby. You and me against the world. And we're going to win. Because we have each other and we have the Lord. And never once has he ever abandoned us or forsaken us or left us alone. But tell you what, Gabby, I wouldn't have wanted to walk this road with anybody else but you. The church is described as the bride of Christ. You see that in Ephesians 5 and Revelation 19. You see the whole idea of covenant between Christ and the church enacted in the Last Supper, Luke 22 and 20, where Jesus says, drink of this cup, it's the blood of the new covenant. This new covenant is discussed as early as Jeremiah 31, hundreds of years before the time of Christ. But you know what's essential in the whole concept of this covenant is action, responsibility and action. And for Jonathan, that meant shielding David from Saul's wrath. And for Jesus, it means shielding us from God's wrath. And we'll say more about that in a moment as we discuss atonement. But this is the third and final point. That friendship, true friendship, involves a degree of sacrifice or advocacy. And Jonathan interceded for David before Saul. I'll read those verses for you, five verses from 20, verses 30 to 34. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, and I just want to remind you now, you're going to hear some rough language. I did not write the Bible. Everyone turn to your neighbor and say, Norm did not write the Bible. Say it. Say, Norm did not write the Bible. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, why should he be put to death? What's he done? But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. And Saul was not a small person. Like, scripture describes Saul as being a head bigger than everybody else. Right now, we're watching the basketball tournament. There's a Canadian in there, plays for Purdue, 7'4". Saul's a big guy, too. He might not be 7'4", but he's big. He's big and he's strong, and he fires this spear at his own son. But Saul hurled a spear at him to strike him. So he wasn't just playing. He wasn't just, you know, wasn't shooting at his feet. He wanted to kill his own son. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death, and Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food for the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. Bible dictionaries, people smarter than me, they define or describe sacrifice as something of value, often an animal, food, or other items, offered up to God as an act of worship, devotion, or penance. For Jonathan to stand up to his father, it cost him a lot. Saul cursed his own son. As long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. That's what Saul says to Jonathan. And when Jonathan stands up for David, Saul throws a spear at him with intent. With intent. I just want to read you a quote that I came across. It's a little bit long, but bear with me. In an apparent effort to bring Jonathan back to his side, Saul appealed to three powerful motivators: shame, guilt, and greed. First, he noted that Jonathan's scandalous betrayal was bringing about personal shame. Second, in an attempt to elicit feelings of guilt, Saul noted that Jonathan's actions were also bringing shame on, and I quote, the mother who bore you, literally the shame of the nakedness of your mother. And that was Ahinoam, whom he himself had just shamed by calling her perverse and rebellious. Third, Saul appealed to his son's greed, noting that as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Having thrust these three barbs into Jonathan's soul, Saul then issued a royal command ordering his son to send and bring David, for he must die. Surely Jonathan must have felt as though he had betrayed his father and dishonored his mother. Surely he must have felt some urge to calm the amenities of royalty for himself. Any one of these emotions could have motivated him to break his commitment to David and obey his father's edict. Remarkably, however, Jonathan resisted all urges to the contrary and defended David. The defense took the form of asking his father two parallel questions that hit at the heart of Saul's responsibilities as God's representative. Why should he be put to death? What has he done? As king over God's people and thus chief enforcer of the Torah, the law, Saul must not execute the innocent, according to Exodus 23:7. And David had not committed any capital offense. However, Saul was no longer acting as God's representative. Matters of justice were being subordinated to the king's mad drive to eliminate David. Since Saul's son had chosen to identify himself with David, he must be treated like David. Thus, Saul hurled a spear at him to kill him. Though Saul's spear missed him, Jonathan got the point. His father intended to kill David. There was something deep and real between David and Jonathan. That same elementary school, Sam and Arm Elementary, we had somebody come to a presentation one day. And he taught us about being blood brothers, something I saw in a Western once upon a time, but where, you know, you cut your thumb and the other person cuts their thumb and you rub the thumb, and the idea is that your blood is now mingled together. In a very spiritual sense, their spirits were mingled together. Jonathan advocated for David and almost cost him his birthright and his life. Jesus gave up his life only to take it back again so that he can advocate for us. In 1 John chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, John writes, "My little children, I'm writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. He is the propitiation for our sins." And if you just take a look at that word pro, it means for. And the rest of it just means he died for you. He died to atone for our sins. He paid the penalty, not only for ours only, but also for the sins of the whole world. And there's other scriptures that bear that out, and I've listed three, but there's much more. There's much, much more. You know, the whole question around martyrdom asks, are you willing to die for Jesus? But just as important, I think, is the question, are you willing to live for Jesus? And what are we willing to give up to be followers of Jesus? You think of the famous story in Luke's gospel about the rich ruler who said, you know, hey, Lord, you know, what do I need to do to follow you? And Jesus says, obey the commands, and lists a bunch. And he says, I've done all that. And he says, okay, great. Sell everything you've got, give it all to the poor, and then come and follow me. And says the man went away sad because he just couldn't bring himself to do that. Just could not do that. And isn't that the kicker, hey? Like, what are we willing to give up to follow the Lord? It's a question somebody put to me once, and I didn't like it then. I don't know if I like it much now. Because it's a very piercing question, isn't it? It's one of those unhappy ones. It's not one of the feel-good ones. There's better questions, happier questions to ask, right? But that's always a tough one. It's always a tough one. Love, commitment, sacrifice, foundations of friendship. Jonathan and David, they model the foundations of biblical friendship. They model these three things, this love, commitment, sacrifice. But, you know, this all points us towards Jesus. Jesus perfects that picture through perfect love. Go back again to John, 1 John chapter 4, verses 16 to 19. So we've come to know and to believe the love that God has for us. God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this is love perfected with us, so that we may have confidence for the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, for fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. Jesus demonstrates perfect love. Jesus demonstrates radical commitment. You think of the incarnation. You look at the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 9 to 13. The true light which gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Jesus left his glorious throne in heaven to come and dwell in the mud and the muck and the mire and the mess and the sin of this world to save us. He was fully committed to his creation to come and seek and save the lost. And that's manifest through his ultimate sacrifice, the cross. Again, the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verses 13 to 15. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I've made known to you. Jesus is the perfect friend, the most ultimate best friend we can ever have. And that's tough in our life experience, where for most of us at least, where friends seem to come and go. It's rare to have a lifelong friend. It's not impossible, but it's rare. You know, I told you about that summer with Mark and his cousin and the skiing, and it was amazing. It was amazing. It was the best summer I had in the 13 years that I lived in Salmon Arm. It was the best summer I had. I was so excited for the next summer, because if this summer was this good, how good was the next summer going to be? And I waited on that calendar, and I knew when he was supposed to come, and I rode my bike. His parents had sold their place in town. They bought an acreage up in Fly Hills. They had this amazing house. It was two stories. It was massive. Had stairs on two ends. If you were little boys, you could just run around. His grandmother, she tolerated all of that. Bless her soul. And it was forest, and there was a stream, and it was amazing. And I rode my bike out there, and I knocked on the door, and Mark's grandpa came to the door, looked at me, and I said, "Hi, is Mark here yet?" And he said, "I guess you haven't heard. Mark was killed in a car accident during the winter." I had no response. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say. All I remember is getting on my bike and riding home. I don't even remember what I did after that. All I knew is my best friend would never, ever come back. So in a sense, I can feel a little bit for Dave and Jonathan as they realize that this is the end, this is their goodbye. But in December of 1986, God reached out to me and extended his friendship to me. He called my name. And we became friends. Not friends in the sense of buddies or pals, but friends in the sense of a relationship that's just rooted in a deep, deep love defined by loyalty and faithfulness, to a commitment into which we say, you know what, I'll do this, you do that, and God's promise to me is everlasting life. I grew up listening to country music. Some of you might know this. If you never heard this story before, I had to listen to a ton of KTEL albums with country and western music, and one of those songs was, "I beg your pardon, I never promised you a..." I wasn't the only one traumatized in younger years. God never promises us a rose garden. He never says it's going to be all ducky and easy and sweet. It's going to be challenging. The road's rocky and craggy and has twists and turns, and you're going to scrape your knee a few times. But he's going to get you home. He's going to get you through that narrow gate where you might have to strip off everything on your person to squeeze through that door, hey? Remember that? We were in Switzerland. My cousin took us through this little alley that got more and more narrow. He had keys to every clandestine door in Zurich, it seemed, and he was in charge of the sewers. So I'll unpack the story for you another day. But then, long story short, we had to get out the other door, which was no more than 15 inches wide. Think about that for a minute. I thought I was going to dislocate my shoulder getting through that thing. I'm stripping everything off, coats, everything, like it's coming off. And Marcus went through, and Ryan's pushing, and Marcus is pulling, and my arm's dislocating. But sooner or later, I pop out the other end, which they joyfully refer to as my true born-again experience. But to get through that narrow door, we have to shed everything of this world, of this life, to enter into that promise of God. But it's a glorious promise, and it's amazing on the other side. You know, we've moved a lot, and moving is hard on friendships. Sometimes things happen that you can't control. Sometimes your best friend dies. But you know, here's the amazing thing about Jesus. He's alive, and he'll never die, and Jesus never, ever moves. Jesus is the picture of perfect love. He's radically committed, and he is our faithful advocate before the Father, because the picture that Paul, the Apostle Paul, paints in one of his epistles is kind of like when you're standing before the judgment seat of God, where God the Father is judging us. The accuser, the name in Hebrew is actually Satan. He's there, he's accusing us of all of our sin before God, the Father, the judge. And sin has to be dealt with, it has to be punished. And Jesus stands up in front of us and for us and says, I've paid that price. This is why I died on that cross. This is why I shed my blood. That capital crime of sin, I've paid that price. Set him free. And God does. God does. You want to talk about sacrifice? There's no greater sacrifice than Calvary. And there's no picture more powerful than an empty tomb 3 days later. Amen? This is the good news we have. This is the hope we have. Steadfast love, covenant, death, resurrection, and ascension, intercession. These are the things that motivate us to worship, that make decisions that honor God, that inform our allegiance and compel us to serve. Because as powerful as the picture of friendship is between Jonathan and David, truly it's Jesus who exemplifies the foundational components of true friendship. Amen. Keith, would you come and lead us in our closing hymn, please?